Now let's discuss formal disciplinary procedures. Disciplinary procedures are of value, but required only when other more positive measures have failed. If you have done the correct things to positively prevent problem behavior, orientation and training, good supervision, effective communication, selective job assigning, and the like, and the person fails to meet the standards, then you have no choice but to follow the steps of positive employee discipline. And sooner or later, this means resorting to formal disciplinary procedures. The major problem you face in formal discipline is the apparent inconsistency that it has with more positive supervisory values and behavior. Most supervisors would like to think of themselves as parental figures, coaches, teachers, counselors, even friends. However, it's hard to maintain that image with employees when you are also called upon to be judge and policeman. Nonetheless, experience with human beings at work shows that the more positive roles of being a supervisor cannot be effectively carried out if the supervisor doesn't also show that he or she can handle firmer bottom-line behaviors. That is, people have to know that a manager will discipline and enforce with sanctions in the punishment sense if that is required by the situation. A basic rule of governance, whether of a nation or in managing an organization, is that those who are given leadership roles must maintain law and order. The bottom line is that people have to know that there is a bottom line. At work, it has been found that when rules are fair and are enforced, it strengthens the dynamics within the work group. When the work group believes things should be done the right way and believes what is requested of them is appropriate, they will tend to subscribe to those standards. They will also turn against employees who don't subscribe to these written and unwritten rules of conduct. So while some managers shrink philosophically from the idea that sanctions and punishment can be good for discipline, it has been found to be a practical necessity at work. It may very well be that the exception proves the rule. The problem behavior that is non-responsive to other remedies and requires a more drastic approach shows the value of more positive management approaches and how greatly positive most people are in responding to them. Nonetheless, I would advise you to avoid disciplining employees when possible. I am not making a case for formal discipline with the idea in mind that we should occasionally hang some poor wretch from a yardarm in order to set an example. In fact, the first principle of formal discipline is to avoid it whenever possible. Out of the collective management experience, there have emerged a number of basic rules of the road for managing formal discipline.
Number one, avoid too many rules.
Too many policies and regulations, particularly those that are unrelated to the immediate job at hand, always seem to cause more problems than they cure. A few sensible rules seem to have more value than lots of little rules that everybody ignores.
Number two, sell people on the rules.
People will work with you only when the rules are reasonable and fair. Prohibition failed in the 1920s because people did not believe the rule was fair.
Number three, enforce the rules.
Law enforcement officials quickly point out that laws are useless when they are unenforceable. If the rule can't be enforced, or if the rule isn't going to be enforced, do away with the rule.
Number four, don't substitute rules for management.
Never use formal disciplinary procedures if other more obvious answers to the employee behavior problem are at hand. Don't punish people who need training or transfer or a different job assignment.
Number five, try communications one more time.
Many apparent disciplinary situations are often simply miscommunication or misunderstanding between the manager and the employee. Don't jump down people's throats if they simply haven't understood. Douglas McGregor, one of the first psychologists to examine motivation in the workplace, is credited with giving us the hot stove rule. The rule suggests the disciplinary process is analogous to touching a red-hot stove. First, There's immediacy. When one burns his hand on the stove, he sometimes is angry not only with himself, but with the stove as well. Nonetheless, he does learn the lesson of not touching the stove in the future, because the burn is immediate. There is no question that there is a cause and effect relationship. Second, there's a warning. The stove provided warning. Since its surface was red, he could see that it was hot, and we could predict what would happen if he did touch it. Third, there's consistency. A stove is consistent in administering pain because it burns every time that it's touched. Finally, it is impersonal. The pain that results is impersonal. Anybody and everybody who touches the stove will get burned regardless. The key point of this analogy is understanding that the stove burns not because whoever touched it is bad, but because he has violated the hard and fast laws of physics. In other words, the pain is directed against the act itself, not against the person. When the hot stove rule is applied in a disciplinary setting, the employee may feel some resentment, but the counseling he's receiving is not a personal attack. In thinking how to apply these points in your shop, ask yourself the following questions. Are you following the principle of immediacy of discipline? How quickly do you respond when you find the company rules or policy have been violated? Do you wait for the annual performance review and mention it then, carrying it around internally with a sense of resentment in the meantime? Or do you call the offending employee in on the same day you see a problem and explain that the behavior he's showing is unacceptable? The employee may not like being confronted, but certainly confronting him on the same day is more likely to get results than letting things slide. In the area of advance warning, have you done a good enough job communicating what the rules and standards are? Have you published these? Have you inserted them in training programs? Have they been referred to at appropriate times in unit meetings? Often what happens in organizations is that the policy is written, put into a dusty book, and never seen again. If you're not going to enforce a policy, then discard it. If some of the rules haven't been enforced in your shop for some time, that doesn't mean that you can't begin enforcing them now. But I strongly suggest that you wait to begin enforcing them until after you have widely communicated that you're going to do so. In certain cases, courts and arbitrators have ruled that a precedent of non-enforcement had been established. What that means is that the rule had become invalid and was no longer applicable. If you change rules, or if you intend to begin enforcing rules that haven't been enforced, it would be appropriate to communicate that in meetings and in writing to all employees. Give them sufficient understanding and time to adapt to the now-to-be-enforced rules. Next, ask yourself, am I consistent in applying discipline? One of the most common complaints in opinion surveys is that supervisors apply the rules inconsistently. Charges of favoritism are leveled and group morale suffers. Is the rule enforced every time? Or is it on-again, off-again enforcement? And are you enforcing the rule against all people, regardless of title or status, and not treating some people, including managers themselves, like they are a privileged elite? The question of consistency also applies to the severity of the punishment or discipline to be applied. Do some people get away with a warning while others get suspended? Was one employee fired for theft but not another? That the punishment should match the crime is an old standard of law, and it certainly applies in this area. Consistency, of course, is hard to maintain and particularly difficult when one considers interdepartmental differences. Some supervisors are more relaxed and others more stringent, and this leads to an unevenness in administration. Differences in enforcement of the rules can be minimized through supervisory training programs and executive review. But while consistent application is desirable, it is not entirely possible. Perhaps one way of dealing with this is to ask the question, is this rule easy to enforce? If the answer is yes, then enforce it against all violators. If the answer is no, then an alternative would be to give awards to employees who not only live up to the letter but the spirit of that law. For example, it may be more effective to pay a bonus for perfect attendance than to dock people's pay for continued absence. The fourth feature of the hot stove rule was impersonality. By impersonality, we mean that the rule is applied against the behavior or the act, not against the person. We don't have to come on like Attila the Hun and say to the person, "Aha, late again, I see," or "I see you are again measuring up to your low level of performance." We instead are always courteous with people. We always show respect for the individual, but we show intolerance and non-acceptance of certain behaviors. So in a counseling discussion, you would focus on the problem of the person being late and what caused that.
I see that being late for work has become a pattern with you, and I'm wondering if you can tell me why that is.
Impersonality represents, in a sense, a detached objectivity. Just as a physician would talk to a patient about symptoms and what could be done to cure the disease, that is the proper approach for the supervisor as well. The doctor doesn't say, "You're bad because you have this disease," or "I don't like you because you have this problem." To approach the person on a personal level and impugn their motives or question their ethics isn't going to change their behavior. Instead, it will create a fighting response, a very powerful emotional resistance, and almost certain non-compliance with the rules in the future. Keep in mind the objective. We are trying to change behavior. Our use of formal discipline should burn people immediately. It should burn every time they do it. It should burn regardless of who they are, and it should burn them without our being emotionally involved. Let's move on now to another area of formal discipline, which is progressive discipline. The concept of progressive discipline is used when an organization applies penalties for either substandard performance or violations of work rules. These penalties become increasingly severe as the infraction worsens or repeats. A typical progressive discipline approach would include 3 to 5 levels of severity. In a 5-level system, there is usually a verbal warning first. Nothing is put in writing, but the employee is told what the problem is with his behavior and that it shouldn't be repeated. The second level is a written reprimand. Here, a note is sent either to the employee or to the employee's file with the employee's knowledge. The third level is a second written reprimand. The fourth level is suspension, usually for a 1 to 3 day period. And the final level is discharge. A 3-step process shortens the chain of events by giving the employee a verbal warning, then a written reprimand, and finally suspension or discharge. In most cases, progressive discipline is spelled out as a management policy. In other settings, it may be written into a union contract. If you want to institute a progressive system, I'd recommend you have no more than 3 levels. You should also make provision for skipping these based on the severity of the offense or based on your collective management judgment. In other words, keep it short and keep it somewhat flexible. You might be wondering, how does the union figure in here? The presence of a union usually brings both positive and negative forces to bear in the discipline arena. On the positive side, there are very clear-cut disciplinary procedures throughout the organization. On the negative side, a union can aggravate the situation by insisting on time delays, appeals, and third-party representation. And it can also inject a much more legalistic tone into the situation. While a union's disciplinary procedures severely restrict what a supervisor can do, this system can eventually help the organization get rid of those who shouldn't be there. One of the reasons that discipline in a union environment often goes sour is that the other elements of positive discipline are missing. Discipline applied in an atmosphere of antagonism does not work. Also, you might want to keep in mind that disciplinary action can be overturned. An examination of court proceedings and arbitration hearings shows that a supervisor's disciplinary actions have been overturned when any of the following conditions exist.
Condition number 1,
insufficient evidence.
When the manager's accusations or beliefs about what the employee is supposed to have done are not founded in fact, when there are no witnesses, no production records, no lost time records, then the supervisor may find his disciplinary decision being overruled.
Condition number two, inadequate warning.
When there is lack of a policy, an absence of communication of that policy, or when the employee receives no warning that he was in violation of the rule prior to a penalty being imposed, then the courts have ruled that warnings given were non-existent or inadequate.
Condition number three, overly severe punishment.
Organizations or managers who do not use a progressive disciplinary approach and who simply go to suspension or termination without a due process approach have sometimes been viewed unfavorably by the courts. This is especially true for first offenses or for workers who have otherwise good work records, or where the punishment simply doesn't seem to fit the crime.
Condition number four, prejudicial action.
Any act of discrimination will place the supervisor's recommendation for discipline in jeopardy. These days, many employees are aware of this and will cry discrimination when none is present in order to fog the issues. Prejudice and bias not only include covered categories of race, age, sex, and the like, but also accusations of a preference for certain educational or experience levels, appearance factors, and so on.
Condition number five, no clear-cut violation of policy.
Even though an employee may be acting contrary to the spirit of a certain policy, if the policy does not specifically cover the behavior he's being punished for, the disciplinary action could be overturned in court.
Condition number six, inadequate documentation.
A supervisor who has claimed that he has followed the progressive disciplinary approach but cannot show any documentation will be considered suspect. Remember, written records are very important, and their very absence can blow a case that the supervisor is trying to establish. Formal discipline is only a part of the overall process of positive discipline. Used alone, it leads to a legalistic and confrontational atmosphere. But used in conjunction with, and sometimes parallel to, other efforts that are supportive and developmental, formal discipline can function very powerfully in channeling behavior. In summary, while you should look at formal disciplinary procedures as a last resort and avoid them whenever possible, they do have their place as a means of enforcing standards of behavior and performance with certain recalcitrant employees. Formal disciplinary procedures tell such workers where the bottom line is.